That man that day, Mr. Holmes, Mr. Johnny Holmes, saved my life because it was the first time I had sought forgiveness because I had tried to outrun my past for 5 years and I was not brave enough to confront it. And he gave me the courage to slowly but surely begin to be open about who I was. And that's when I recognized that sometimes our biggest vulnerabilities are our greatest strengths.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Ravencast. My name is Adam Erickson, and I am here today with Christian Picciolini. Hi, Christian.
Hi, Adam. I'm glad we got this to work.
Oh, man, the last like five episodes that I've done, there have been so many technical difficulties. You'd think that I would figure it out by now, but no, I'm not. I'm not going to figure it out. I refuse.
We do not conform to the norm.
No. And Facebook is causing us problems, causing me problems again. So Mark Zuckerberg is in the news. Facebook is causing all kinds of problems for all kinds of people. So I just say that we should just rebel against Facebook and just not do it anymore.
I don't know if I concur with that.
Okay. All right. That sounds good.
It's the ideal that I'm happy to entertain there, Adam.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Christian, welcome to the Ravencast, and we are here on any meeting, and hopefully we'll get a few more audience members in. If you are watching this, you can leave a comment or a question in the attendee chat room, and I will bring those comments and questions in. This is the Ravencast, a product of the Raven Review, an online magazine where we talk about the rivalry and violence that so often infects our personal lives and the world. And we try to find and offer solutions, peaceful solutions to those conflicts. And one of the ways that we do that is by having an annual award called the Raven Award for Arts and Entertainment. And this last year, we gave the Raven Award to the one and only Christian Picciolini. Yeah.
So honored.
Do you have the award there?
I do. Let me find it. Just one second.
Okay.
I lost your screen. Can you see me?
Yes, there it is.
This is the wonderful, very hefty Raven Award that I have won. I'm very proud of it. It is very heavy. Let me just say that. Big. It's about the size of my head. I often walk around with it on my shoulder when I'm walking down the street.
I like it.
No, I really don't do that, but it's such an honor. I mean, to have been recognized about writing, on a period of my life that, frankly, I would rather forget is very special to me because I know, and I hesitate to use the word timely, because really what I wrote about is timeless. And unfortunately, we deal with these issues on a constant basis of racism and xenophobia and extremism. And it's something that I hope, as you've recognized and I'm very grateful for, that other people will recognize and inspire them to make good happen.
Well, that's what I appreciate so much about your work is that you can fall in, I can start to fall into despair because there are so many justice issues out there that it feels like we need to go deal with. And I can swirl into, oh my God, the world is going into hell. And you provide so much hope for me as I'm reading your book and you say, I wish that I could forget about this period, or I'm just so glad that you got through that period and are here to tell a different story. So,
well, I appreciate that. And, I'm not alone. There are a lot of people like me who've managed to find their way out and are now doing really amazing work to share their narrative with other people who might still be stuck in there. Unfortunately, our stories are all fairly similar. We experienced some sort of a trauma that went unresolved and have courageously the folks who've made it out on their own have found a way to deal with that and then share and then be brave enough to share their stories with other people. And it's making such a huge impact in this day and age that I couldn't be more grateful to them who inspire me on a daily basis.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful thing. Well, before we get into our chat, I just want to tell people that the book that Christian wrote is called White American Youth: My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement and How I Got Out. And if there was an award for like a subtitle, you should get an award for that subtitle. It isn't it's the perfect subtitle for your book.
I appreciate that. It was one that I fought hard against.
Really?
For a long time. Yeah, I thought it was too long and too, you know, blatant. It wasn't subtle enough. I don't know. I'm more of a subtle person, but certainly the book is not subtle. So I guess the title fits it. Thank you, though.
Well, I am one of the lucky many who got the original version, Romance of Violence, Memoirs of a Skinhead. Right. And this is how much I loved it. Like, can you see? No. Yeah, there you go. Notes all over the place. And like, wow. I don't know why I did that. But anyway, fantastic book. If people want to be inspired about what to do with white supremacy and hate groups, go check out this book. Read it. And Christian, like, the first question that I want to ask you is about white supremacy. Because a lot of people are saying that white supremacy is on the rise during the last couple of years, or maybe even the last decade, white supremacy is on the rise. Other people in Facebook groups that I'm a part of that aren't white supremacist groups say that white supremacy is actually a myth. So I was just wondering, like, what is white supremacy? Maybe it's a problem of defining the term that people don't understand it. And is it on the rise?
Well, I guess it's really how you look at the term. Maybe we should define a term. I think to some people who say it doesn't exist, they might be seeing the term white supremacy as whites being superior to others. And if they don't agree that whites are superior, well, that's a good thing. I think that's acknowledging reality. And then there are folks who see, you know, white supremacy as an ideology. And I can tell you it absolutely exists and is growing. In fact, it's been growing for over 250 years in this country. We've just seen it metastasize from one cancer to another to another. And in this day and age, you know, we're dealing with one that is very benign looking in many ways, because it's wearing a suit or khakis and a polo instead of, you know, having a shaved head or wearing boots or a Klan robe or, you know, sporting a swastika armband like it did for me at points in my life. So while we're looking at something different, the idea of white supremacy, you know, is something that exists as a movement. It's also something that I believe exists in our institutions. In many of our systems, still today. For those that believe it doesn't exist, I would urge them to speak to a person of color and ask them that same question, because I suspect they'll get an answer or something else.
It is an interesting point that most of the people that I hear saying white supremacy doesn't exist are white people.
Right. I would even guess that all the people that are saying it doesn't exist are white people, not most.
Yeah.
You know, it's a funny thing. You know, we live in our bubbles, and well-intentioned, well-meaning people sometimes who are not racist may live in such a kind of secluded environment that they may not see it exist in their, you know, where they are. Certainly I would encourage them to poke their head out from time to time to understand what's happening to their fellow human beings and understand and empathize that, you know, we may see things differently than the folks who are on the receiving end.
Yeah. Empathy is a theme that runs throughout your book. And I think it's one of the things that really opened me up to you as you were going through your childhood and getting into the skinhead movement. I was reading it and I was empathizing with your history and liking you, even though you were doing these horrible, horrible things. And I think that that's one of the gifts that I received from your book, because we often think that why would anybody get involved with a hate group? Well, it must be because they're hateful, racist people. But your story tells it differently.
Yeah, and I think that that's a misnomer that you know, people are raised in these racist environments, and they're the only ones who become you know, haters, and that's simply not true. I came from a very loving household. My parents were immigrants from Italy and from Europe, who settled in the U.S. in the mid '60s, and they were often the victims of prejudice. So it wasn't something that I was raised with. It wasn't part of my family DNA. And in fact, for most people in this movement, they may have seen some racism, but, you know, something I would call, you know, mainstream, old world racism that, you know, maybe is generational. They didn't see the level of extremism in their homes. You know, they may have heard that there goes the neighborhood comment, you know, from grandpa or an uncle or something like that. But most were not conditioned to hate at the level that they hated when they were in the movement. What they experienced was some sort of a marginalization, a trauma. For me, it was a feeling of abandonment because my parents had to work 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. And as a young kid growing up, I didn't quite understand why they were gone. I thought it was because of something that I did, not recognizing that they were working hard. So I went in search as this lonely, bullied, marginalized young kid. I went in search for another family. Because I was ambitious. I did believe in myself, even though I had low self-esteem. I still was searching for something and for a place to belong. And one day at 14 years old, a man walked up to me and he essentially promised me that paradise that I was looking for. And he did that by recognizing my vulnerabilities and by filling those voids in with promises of inclusion and acceptance and purpose. Something that I didn't really find in you know, my family, and had to find it externally. But it was for all intent and purpose, I should not have gone down that road. And I often joke, had a group of ballerinas, you know, approached me in that alley that day instead of America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader, I probably could have been the greatest ballet dancer on earth. Unfortunately, you don't want to see that. But unfortunately, I went down a really bad path in search of that same type of acceptance. So yeah, it's trauma is the underlying theme, I would say, as people are searching for identity, community, and purpose that can lead them down that road.
So as I'm reading your book and I'm hearing you talk about it, it seems to me pretty clear that if we had alternative ways of giving kids meaning in their lives, giving children meaning in their lives, teenagers meaning in their lives. I was a youth pastor for 8 years, and just like the camaraderie in that situation and those kinds of things, just would obviously help, right? Like, how can we start fostering positive role models, I guess?
Well, that's a question I ask myself all the time. You know, I think we, you know, as adults, we tend to jump in when there's already an issue and then try and fix it by prescribing a solution. And what works for us or our generation or maybe even an older generation, certainly not going to work for the new generation. So, you know, I really try to listen, and I advocate that we empower our young people, you know, our most vulnerable, really, at the earliest age possible, to teach empathy and compassion and inclusion and to expand their cultural understanding of different, you know, different people from all over the world at the youngest age possible, but also to understand that young people are idealistic and that they're passionate about certain things, and that we need to amplify and provide, you know, resources for them to really do something with those passions and with that idealism. Because if we don't, they will find it sometimes in very negative ways. And there are, you know, sinister people who are preying on young people's vulnerabilities and their weaknesses and their urge to matter and to be somebody. And, you know, frankly, we're letting down young people. We're letting down our most vulnerable and our most promising, you know, people on earth. You know, if we just did more to listen, to understand their needs, and then ask how we can help and guide rather than step in and just, you know, make the solution for them, I think we'd be in better shape. Because frankly, these days, I don't know a whole lot of adults who are thinking soundly.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the students in Parkland, Florida, right?
Yeah.
What do you make of that movement?
I think it's amazing. I think that's exactly what I'm talking about, is that we underestimate young people. But what, you know, they're technologically more advanced than my generation. They have access to more information than my generation. They seem more motivated in social justice issues more than my generation was. And I think we do underestimate them. And what I've seen, you know, happen after Parkland is this amazing movement of young people who are actually changing something. They're not just talking about it. They're not arguing across the aisle. They're not stopping or filibustering people from getting progress done. What they're actually doing is saying, you're going to listen to us. And people have listened, and people, you know, laws have been changed because of this in places where, you know, gun laws, for instance, would never appear to ever be changed in places like Florida. So, you know, I applaud them. And I think that as an adult, as somebody who's an activist myself and somebody who supports what they're doing, I think we need more movements or one larger movement of young people to really make their voices heard at a very critical time.
We often say that adults are more mature than children and stuff, but I think that we're seeing that, like, this leadership from these children is pretty amazing, because there are adults who are trying to silence their voices, like saying, why should I listen to a high school student, and things like that. And they don't seem to be resentful. They don't seem to be super, super angry about that. They just want to keep having their voice heard.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, it's their world, the young people. We're just living in it right now. You know, we kind of created, we had our chance, and we continued to, you know, some of us continue to screw it up, and, you know, foster division. And I'm not talking about either one of us per se, but, there are people out there, let's just say, at the highest levels of power who, you know, are creating an atmosphere where, you know, it's very hard to get along. It's very hard to get things done. And it's very hard to understand who we are anymore, because there's such a different view from everybody of what America is today and where we should go. You know, maybe our young folks can show us the way.
Yeah, I hope so too. Yeah. Well, I want to get more into your book, White American Youth, and how you talk about, it was a real learning experience for me in understanding the skinhead groups. You would talk about, I just assumed that all skinheads were racist.
Right. And that's incorrect.
Not the case.
No, there are, I mean, the skinhead image that everybody knows and understands is the racist one, but there is another subculture of skinheads that are anti-racist. There are other subcultures that are traditionalist, that just like to listen to non-political skinhead music and dress like a skinhead. So there are different factions within the skinhead movement, but obviously the more visible one is the one that I was a part of, which is the neo-Nazi or the racist skinhead movement. So we should, you know, be careful not to judge a book on their cover, because many of the anti-racist, sometimes even some of the Antifa people and the protesters at these rallies against the racist skinheads are actually anti-racist skinheads.
Okay, I did not know that before. That's very interesting. One of the things that we talk about in mimetic theory at the Raven Foundation is the nature of violence and how it can't be contained. And many of your stories that you tell are not just stories where you would be violent against African American or Latino, but how violence would infect your own inner group.
Mm. It was, you know, I never met a white supremacist with positive self-esteem. And, you know, you put a bunch of highly type A individuals with not a whole lot of self-esteem in a room together, and it can turn pretty ugly when people are fueled by ego. So there was a lot of anger. There was a lot of, depression and marginalization and trauma that had gone unresolved with these folks in this movement. And there was a lot of infighting, and there was a lot of, you know, jogging for leadership positions and disloyalty. So it was something that was a pretty prevalent thread throughout the movement. And I'm actually seeing it today in the modern day movement, where we're seeing many of the same things, a lot of the infighting, a lot of, you know, trying to get into that leadership position and boost ego and get airtime, especially now in the times of new media where the internet and you can consume content just about anywhere. There are a lot of platforms that these people are fighting for, and they seem to be winning them because we keep tuning in, and they keep causing problems for us to talk about. So that is their goal, is to create chaos, to provoke, and they seem to be doing a fair job at that.
I create chaos is something that our president seems to do a lot, and provoke. And this gets me into dog whistle
politics. Let's just keep going on. If we're going to talk about that scapegoating, we can talk about that in terms of mimetic theory, blaming the other. There's the desires of wanting to be like other people, this fear of something being taken away. So yeah, we see a lot of that being mimicked from the very top. And in fact, much of the rhetoric is very similar. It's very divisive and very xenophobic and exclusionary.
Can you talk about dog whistles? Because I think this is a phrase that gets, it's another phrase that gets battered around quite a bit, and people may not really understand what it means and how it's being used. It's a vague term. So can you, but when I read your book, it just made perfect sense to me.
So a dog whistle, in the sense that we're hearing about it in the news these days, is it's a phrase that's used as coded language, so that it falls on certain ears and kind of goes above everybody else's head as normal language. So one example of a dog whistle coming from the administration to, let's say, the far right, is the term globalist or globalism. And what that term would have meant to us when I was in the movement was this idea of a global Jewish conspiracy that promoted multiculturalism to destroy white culture. So when we hear things like white genocide, that's what we're talking. We're not talking about the annihilation of white people dying. We're talking about a culture dying. So when you hear those terms, it's the whole fear of having that identity taken away from you. So the globalists are typically, when we hear the term globalist, it's typically referring to Jewish elite. Or what they think, are this Jewish, these Jewish organized elites. Another term could be liberal media. A lot of the movement associates liberal media with what they would consider Jewish run media. So the term Jewish media that we used to use has now suddenly become more palatable and become liberal media. And to most people, they think they're talking about liberals, but for people on the far right, they may be talking about liberals, but they're directing those words towards, again, a Jewish elite that's running the media and promoting kind of a multiculturalist agenda that they believe is going to destroy their white culture or create a white genocide.
So these dog whistles provide support, or they provide encouragement to white supremacy groups?
They do, but they also make really racist terms sound very palatable. Conspiracies sound academic and sound. They make the vernacular of this movement now become embedded into the mainstream media, mainstream society. People, I think, use the word not knowing what they're saying, just kind of repeating it. But to the folks who kind of seeded these words into the vernacular, they know exactly what they were trying to do. They were polishing their once hateful message into words that are easier to swallow for the average person.
Wow. Yeah. So in your book, you use music, like the power of music to spread this message. A few years ago, I interviewed someone about the power of music to provide healing towards others, but you used it in a slightly different way. Can you talk about the power of music?
Well, music for us was like our internet. We didn't have the internet 30 years ago to use as a platform for propaganda, to use as a social network to build a movement. So music for us was a way to educate people through propaganda, through the lyrics that, essentially pushed the ideas that we were selling. But it also created an environment, because our music was pretty forbidden and we couldn't you know, rent a club or get booked at a venue to play racist music, we would often have to do it on private land or in a warehouse. And it would only happen, you know, two or three times a year. So bands from all over the country would come together and their fans would come together. And suddenly you had, you know, a couple of events a year that would draw several hundred people. So it was like an online group for us. It was our way to collectively come together and see people that you'd only see two or three times a year. While there, the music would provide an education. It would amplify the anger and the angst that already existed. It would provide a bonding experience. And it would allow us to communicate with people because, you know, we only had post office boxes to communicate with each other back then and landlines. You know, so it was very much like how they're gathering on the internet today and social media, where they're able to support each other, where they're able to influence each other with messages and rally. It was almost like a pep rally that happened a couple times a year. Music for me was what drew me in. It wasn't the politics. I was 14 years old. I did not understand I didn't understand the politics. It was the music that really brought me in. I think we have a question. I just saw a question pop up.
Yes.
How do I see those?
On the left, there's the attendee list. And if you, in the middle is attendee chat. And if you click attendee chat.
There we go. Okay. Cool.
So yeah, the question.
Can I answer?
Yes.
Can I answer the question?
Yes. I'll bring it in. Did you have many Russian nationalist support?
Good question, Richard E. Kidd. I don't know if that's your real name or not.
It is.
What's really interesting? what I've seen happen over the last 30 years is this deep hatred for communism and Russia within this movement to now a very strong embrace of Putin and kind of the Kremlin's agenda. It's a really bizarre turn of events for me. So no, I wasn't aware of any Russian support, although there were rumors that people like David Duke were going to Russia, were spending a lot of time in Eastern Europe. We were, you know, in large part, very, very opposed to anything that had a communist feeling to it. At that time, I don't believe there were very many national socialists or neo-Nazis in Russia. Today, however, Russia has one of probably the largest population of neo-Nazi, you know, whether they're skinheads or alt-right or whatever, in the world. And also, we're seeing so many European neo-Nazis going to Russia and the Ukraine to train, to get, you know, weapons training, hand-to-hand combat training, and then going to fight on the front lines in the Ukraine. Likewise, I'm also seeing people in the United States now going to paramilitary camps within the United States to train with some of the more violent terrorist cell groups, groups like Adam Waffen Division, for instance, in the United States, to do that. But it's really interesting. There's so much support coming in the way of technology and bots, but also in the way of ideology and members from Russia today that would not have been acceptable in my day. And it's really kind of mind-boggling to me that so many of the top, what we're calling white nationalists, even though I refuse to use that word because it's their marketing term to seem less hateful, they're getting support from Russia, direct financial support. They're getting technological support. Many of the prominent folks in America are either Russian or married to Russian nationals.
Wow. Thank you, Richard. I had no idea that was happening. So I'm glad Richard got that question in. Wow. So we've talked about how you got into the skinhead movement. How did you get out?
Well, you know, for 8 years that I was in, I always had doubts. You know, it wasn't part of my DNA growing up. So I always had kind of my foundation that was questioning me in the background, but I would suppress that because what I was receiving, I felt fulfilled me more. I'd gone from powerless to powerful almost overnight. But I had those questions and there were moments, especially towards the end, where I finally was able to open up and allow people who wanted to be compassionate to me and wanted to show me empathy do that. And I started to receive compassion from the people I least deserved it from when I least deserved it. And it was transformative because the demonization that I had in my head for 8 years against African Americans and Jewish people and gay people and anybody who essentially wasn't white, and in fact, most white people as well, when I began to actually have meaningful interactions and discussions with the people I thought I hated, I recognized that we had more similarities than differences, and the differences were actually the beauty of what we were. It was the food and the culture and the language and the traditions and all these amazing things that are so important to me. They didn't have to show me compassion. They didn't have to be empathetic towards me. They knew about all the things that I was doing and saying, yet they still found it more effective, or they chose to try that, and it worked. And there were people who were violent as well, and that would push me further in my hole. But it was the folks who were, courageous enough to say, I'm going to treat this horrible man, not like a monster, but like a broken human being. And that's what was effective for me. And in fact, that's what I use when I work to help disengage other people, is I'm not aggressive. I'm not interested in debating them. I'm interested in listening and understanding and building a rapport and seeing what I can do to help them become more resilient.
This is one of the big questions that I have for you, because everyone that I identify with is wanting to protest, right? Like go to protest movements and marches. And you talk about going to a skinhead march, and there were protesters there, peaceful protesters, right? And you're there and you're screaming this hateful rhetoric, and these people who are singing peace songs all of a sudden start saying very hateful things towards you. And they even start like tearing up the sidewalk and throwing concrete at you. And it just solidifies your position, having this hatred thrown back at you.
Right. There were two things that were very important to us and are still very important to this movement. And that was to provoke people so that we could use their hatred towards us as a victim narrative. So there are two things that are important to remember that extremists love. They love violence and they love silence. If we're silent, if we refuse to acknowledge that they exist, if we just ignore them by not protesting, by not calling them out or holding them accountable for their actions, they will continue to grow. They'll continue to spread their message. The cancer will spread, and it will eventually infect the average person like it has been. We've been sweeping, racism under the rug for so long, thinking we were living in a post-racial society. We've elected our first African-American president, and suddenly racism, in many people's minds didn't exist, like those folks that you mentioned earlier. But the truth is it grew during that period because we refused to acknowledge it. Extremists also love violence. They go and they march intentionally in liberal or progressive areas to provoke. As far back as the 1970s, when the American Nazi Party marched in Skokie, Illinois, a predominantly Jewish suburb of Chicago, to Berkeley, California recently, and Charlottesville, Virginia last August, and places like Boston. They do that because they know that when they go there, they provoke good people to do sometimes very violent things. And then they turn around and they say, you see how intolerant people are of us. They're the haters. We're not the haters. In fact, we're the victims. We don't have free speech. We're not allowed to do this. And they use, things that are hard to fight against, like free speech. Of course, they have the right to say what they want. But the minute that that affects somebody else, and the minute that they use that to provoke somebody else, that is no longer free speech anymore. That's a provocation. So I'm not condoning the violence. What I'm saying is the violence is actually counterproductive to trying to suppress their ideas, because it pushes them further and deeper into their ideology. In their own minds, it proves that they are under attack by the enemy. And then they can spin that. The very, very smart, very savvy propagandists can spin that as a narrative that makes them the victim and helps them recruit even further. I'm not completely against, what everybody's calling now this anti-fascist movement, Antifa, because I think throughout our history of the world. We've had very important anti-fascist, sometimes violent protesters go against people that, you know, were intent on hurting others and saved lives. And in many cases, you know, averted disasters and wars and rebellions. So there's a time for that. But the time for that is not now. The time for what we have to go through now is to embrace the young people because they're our future, to teach them and to work with the people who are in these movements to pull them out. Because we can't let the rhetoric that's coming from the very top infect us and turn us against each other.
It reminds me, about a year ago, there was this video where Richard Spencer was giving an interview and somebody came up and punched him in the face, which brought up this like cultural wide question: is it ever okay to punch a Nazi in the face? Right. And
I can tell you, it did not change Richard Spencer one bit. I could tell you he got a heck of a lot of publicity from that. I can tell you that it also probably made a lot of good people now want to punch a Nazi because they see that as a popular solution. But I can also tell you that never in the history of the world has a Nazi changed their opinion because they got punched in the face. It's probably made them hate more. So, as far as being an effective strategy, it may boost your own ego by doing it and make you feel good. But I guarantee you it's not, it's doing nothing but putting more violence into the world and creating more hate.
Yeah. Wow. So you left the skinheads about 20 years ago?
22 years ago and maybe almost 23 in 1995. It was a time in my life that was very dark once I left. But certainly, you know, leaving was the right thing to do. But I didn't know who I was when I left, even though I was treating other people with compassion and respect and was very, inclusive. I didn't understand who I was and I didn't know how to forgive myself. And in fact, I was treating myself very poorly during that time.
Yeah. But how did you get out of that to where you are now?
Well, for 5 years after I left, like I said, I suffered a depression where, you know, there were mornings where I wished I hadn't woken up. And a friend at the time in 99 had recognized that I was not in a good place. And she told me she didn't want me to die. And I listened and she suggested I go apply for a job where she was working at IBM. And I thought she was crazy because here I was, this, you know, ex-Nazi, had tattoos all over my body. I didn't look like somebody who would work at IBM. I went to 6 high schools. I was kicked out of all of them, one of them twice. I didn't go to college, didn't even own a computer. It was kind of a ridiculous, thought to even go, but I went. After a few interviews, I got the job and I was thrilled to hear that I was going to learn how to network computers and install computers and something I didn't know. And I thought had, you know, some promise until I found out where I'd be going on my first day. And out of the literally millions of places that IBM could have placed me, call it karma, destiny, God's will, fate, whatever. They put me at my old high school, the same high school I'd been kicked out of twice, to install their network and computers. And, of course, you know, like a schoolboy, I was terrified to go to school on my first day because I knew they were going to recognize me and I was going to be fired and thrown out and embarrassed and I'd go back to, you know, a miserable life. And in fact, within the first few hours, the African-American security guard whom I'd been physically violent towards and tormented verbally crossed my path. And when I recognized him, though he didn't recognize me, I followed him to the parking lot and I approached him and I said I was sorry. And I extended my hand and we spoke and he embraced me and we talked for a long time and he made me promise that I would tell my story. And it eventually turned into the book that you guys were so gracious in awarding me this amazing gift. I'm going to put it up again because it's so awesome.
Yeah, it's good.
That man that day, Mr. Holmes, Mr. Johnny Holmes, saved my life because it was the first time I had sought forgiveness because I had tried to outrun my past for 5 years. And I was not brave enough to confront it. And he gave me the courage to slowly but surely begin to be open about who I was. And that's when I recognized that sometimes our biggest vulnerabilities are our greatest strengths.
And now you dedicate your life to helping people get out of white supremacy movements. And
yes,
one of the things that you touched on earlier was now we have the internet that you didn't have when you were growing up. How has the internet changed white supremacy movements, and how do you use the internet to battle this?
Well, you know, the internet is both a very useful tool and a powerful tool, but also one that can be used in, very negative ways. White supremacists these days are using the internet to recruit. They are creating these communities of very marginalized young people who are looking for that identity, community, and purpose and are unable to find it elsewhere. And they're seducing them with this narrative that they can change the world and that they're marginalized because of certain groups or certain people. But the way that they're doing it is very disturbing to me, because they're literally trolling safe zones, places like depression forums or autism forums and schizophrenia. They're even going into online gaming chat rooms and speaking to people over these multiplayer games to recruit them, because they know in large part that many people in these communities are often marginalized, that they're often on the fringes and have been bullied. And they step in with this promise of paradise, just like somebody did for me. And but it's also being used in good ways to serve positive counter narratives to help people disengage. So, I mean, the internet is a very powerful tool that can be used for good and bad. There's a ton of misinformation and propaganda and conspiracy theory that can be found. And unfortunately, it's that type of misinformation that has led to so much of the tragedy that we've experienced in the last couple of years. Everybody from, somebody like Dylan Roof, who decided to Google, white on black or black on white crime statistics and landed on a propaganda website that inflated those statistics, pushed him to go out there and murder 9 innocent people. There are, there are websites dedicated to just this awful conspiracy theory and propaganda that, has produced so many of the mass tragedies that we've experienced, that, it's really become a detriment, because it's so easy to fall onto these websites. The algorithms on the internet love to curate for us. Just like when we shop on Amazon and it suggests products for us, when we consume news and content on the internet, the algorithms will continue to feed us things that it thinks we like. And if you start by landing on some, conspiracy theory website, or accidentally click on a clickbait headline that takes you to some propaganda site, you do that enough times and the algorithms will continue to feed you that type of information until you go so deep down a rabbit hole that becomes your reality.
It's a scary thing. So but you're using the internet in a positive way.
I am. I am using the internet to serve counter narratives to people. So I produced a series of videos for an organization that I was a part of that featured formers, that featured people like me talking about what they were a part of. And it was very effective. I actually won an Emmy for it, which I'm very proud of.
And almost as good as the Raven Award, by the way.
No, the Emmy's on the other side of the room. Right. It's not even close to being as shiny and beautiful as that I received from you. But now what I'm doing through a new organization that I'm launching called Free Radicals, and eventually it will be at freeradicals.org, is a counter-narrative. So when somebody goes to search online for a whole series of pretty common search terms for the far right, like did the Holocaust happen, or what is black on white crime statistics, what they'll actually find is that the first result will be a link to my site, freeradicals.org, that says Exposing the Holocaust. And when they click on it, it actually takes them to a page that explains to them how their search is dangerous and will take them through the steps of how that same information that they were looking for misinformed people like Dylan Roof and Elliot Rodger and some other folks who went and committed these crimes. And then there will be ultimately a place to seek help. So they'll be able to reach out, you know, with help disengaging or help finding more honest, more genuine information.
I want to be able to help you spread good in the world. if anybody is listening to this, how can we help you spread your message out to others?
Well, you know, everybody has their tools. You know, not everybody's a protester or an activist or a political voice or, you know, social justice warrior, as they like to call us. But everybody has their tools. You know, if we're a teacher, we can certainly teach more inclusively and dig into some of our darker history that we often gloss over, you know, very rapidly. If we're musicians, you know, the music is powerful. It can be used for good, and we should write and create art that is inclusive. If we're police officers, you know, we hold our other police officers accountable when something happens that, you know, isn't just. Everybody has a tool and everybody can influence the people directly around them. And that's what I would encourage people to do. But more directly, I would encourage people on April 1st, to go to freeradicals.org and to donate to our new organization, which we'll be launching as a nonprofit on April 1st.
I love it. April Fool's Day.
Maybe that's not a good day to launch it on second thought. You said, well, April 2nd.
as a pastor, I will tell you that it's also Easter. So you get some resurrection in there. So that's awesome.
Interesting. Really great way to illustrate my own change. So.
Yes, I love it. So Shannon asks, what's on the horizon for you? What projects are in your future? What projects are on your wish list?
Wow. Okay. Good question, Shannon. Thank you. Well, I think I touched a little bit on what's on the horizon. I will be launching this new org, Free Radical. So stay tuned for more information on that. I am also going to spill the beans a little bit without giving away too much information, but I will have, I will be hosting a TV series on a network that will essentially be taking, the series will be taking people through my daily work and helping people disengage from extremism and working with communities to help them heal after they've been affected by hate.
Wow.
Stay tuned for that.
Dropped on the Ravencast. Awesome.
Then this is probably the first time I've talked about it publicly. So
wow, can you tell us when that'll be coming?
You know, it's we've been talking about May as a release, but you know, that's up in the air right now, and I won't really know. But you know, I'll be talking about it if people want to follow me on Facebook or on Twitter. I'm sure I will give the heads up there. You know, I've really been very excited about building a global intervention network. And I think Free Radicals is going to be that entry point to bring in partners from all over the world that are doing very similar work, whether it's mothers in Mali who are helping young people, you know, not join extremist groups, or former fighters in Lebanon that are stopping young people from joining the civil war there. There are amazing groups all over the world who are doing this intervention work. But they're unrecognizable because they're so small or they're so interspersed. I really want to try and create this network of people that can be deployed to help people in their communities at a moment's notice and even be proactive about it.
Wonderful. I love it. And if people want to keep up with you on Facebook or Twitter, how can they find you?
They can just type in my name. My Facebook is just facebook.com/officialchristianpicciolini. My Twitter is at cpicciolini, or they can just go to christianpicciolini.com if you don't know how to spell that. Just type in X neo-Nazi skinhead into Google and something will pop up.
Nice. Awesome. And I also want to promote your YouTube channel. because I binge watched your YouTube channel the last day or two. It's just, you have a lot of really great stuff on there. So that's just, if they just put Christian Picciolini in the YouTube search engine, they can find you there. And your Emmy Award winning documentary is up there too. So, so go check that out. So Christian, thank you so much.
Adam, thank you so much. I can't tell you how grateful I am for you guys awarding me this great honor, and for recognizing, you know, the importance of the story and for my work. And, it's really just been great, to talk to you and to work with you and to understand that what you guys are doing is so similar to what I do on a daily basis, that if we can just spread that message, you know, everybody can do the work that we do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love it. The book again is White American Youth, My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement and How I Got Out. You can find it on Amazon or wherever great books are sold. So there it is one more time. Christian, yeah, you walk around the street with that and people are like, oh, it's the Raven Award. They're very nice.
You know, I walk around with a bird on my shoulder like a pirate.
That's good. Awesome.
Thanks, Adam. Thank you, everybody, for joining. I really appreciate the questions. Just to answer Richard's last question, will I be coming to Cleveland or Pittsburgh or Ohio or Pennsylvania? Go to my website, and I have an events page there that's updated all the time, and you'll be able to see it there.
Awesome. Thank you, Christian, and thank you, everybody, for your comments and questions. Stay up to date on all things Ravencast on the Raven Foundation Facebook page, and the Raven Review at theravenfoundation.com. I love that coffee cup. It's fantastic.
It's a dove. No, a bird.
Doves. Ravens, doves. It's all good.
Awesome. Thank you.
Until next time, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.